This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. It's been manifesto week in the election campaign, as you well know. Labour, Lib Dems and the Tories all launching their blueprints, and there are more to come this week. We'll be hearing about those. Tonight, then, we've brought together two old hands at the manifesto writing process who know all about the arguments, the endless redrafts, the agony behind the scenes. I can see the pain etched in their faces now. David Willetts helped write the Conservative Manifesto in 1997. He was Universities and Science Minister in the coalition government under David Cameron. He stood down at the last election and is now a member of the House of Lords and chairs the Resolution Foundation think tank. Welcome to you.
Good evening.
Stuart Wood, now Lord Wood of Anfield, an academic and advisor to Gordon Brown, and then Ed Miliband throughout his time as Labour leader, is here as well. Fresh memories of Labour's 2015 offer to the voters as well. We're joined from our Edinburgh studio by the SNP's Deirdre Brock, one of that wave of Scottish nationalists who came into Westminster at the last election and is hoping to return. And
hello.
She speaks for the SNP on devolution issues. Hello, Deirdre.
Hi there.
And here as well, George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times. Well, some of your colleagues, George, have been calling this the first wobbly weekend of the campaign. Every campaign needs a wobble, I suppose, to shake us up. But why are they saying that?
Well, I mean, it's been a bit of a bad weekend for the Conservative Party. Theresa May's getting a bit of a battering over her plans for social care reform, the reforms dubbed a dementia tax by Jeremy Corbyn, which has pushed the Tories back onto the back foot, coupled with a series of opinion polls in the Sunday papers, which have showed the gap narrowing between Tories and the Labour. But we should put all of this into perspective, because the gap, even on these improved showings for Labour, still put Jeremy Corbyn around 10 points behind Theresa May. Nevertheless, what looked like it was going to be a fairly straightforward presidential procession for Theresa May into number 10 at least now looks a little bit more interesting after the last 24 hours.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, some of you here and Deirdre as well, you've had these moments in campaigns. I mean, Deirdre, I guess you remember that moment during the independence referendum in 2014 when YouGov gave Alex Salmond a 2-point lead. Independence was in the lead. Remember those days?
Oh, yes, I do. And I remember the three party leaders abandoning everything down in Westminster and galloping up over the border to promise us the vow, which hasn't really resulted in, I think, what many people were expecting. And I think recently a poll showed that about 9% of Scots believe the vow has been kept in full. I think an insider's book described it as a hastily arranged front page, which...
Well, it certainly did. It was a moment that shocked the campaign. Just as Stuart, I mean, looking back to 2015, there was Millie fandom and all of that, and lots of talk about Labour being in coalition. And then that moment when Ed Miliband took questions from a Question Time audience and was asked about whether the last government had overspent.
Yeah.
He said, no, I don't think so. And suddenly, everything seemed to come crashing down.
Yeah, I think looking back, that wasn't a wobble in the sense of a policy that went wrong, which is what we've seen this week with the Conservatives. What he said captured what a lot of people felt was a weakness of ours, and it crystallised it. It came very near the end, by the way, of the campaign, so it was different. So I think it's remembered because it captured something a lot of people felt was a problem for us, and that's the reason it sticks in the memory.
David Willetts, this current wobbly weekend, the polls narrowing, the suggestion your colleagues out campaigning now are facing tough questions about those Tory manifesto plans for social care and what's being called by some, as George said, a dementia tax. If you were still an MP, how worried would you be about damage to the Tory core vote?
I think that, you know, clearly there's a lively debate about these proposals, but look, it's a section of the manifesto about a fair contract between the generations. And for me personally, and I think for millions of people across the country, that really matters. What we're trying to do is improve the amount of money going into social care. But instead of that cost being borne by the generality of taxpayers, many of them younger people, we're saying that it's only right that more affluent pensioners with very substantial assets have to contribute. But of course, anybody with under £100,000 won't contribute. I personally think that is exactly the kind of tough decision which we have to take in the context we're in now. So I fully understand if I were out on the doorstep, I'm sure people would be asking me questions. But I think there are some pretty good answers to those questions.
But the fact that it is the pensioners who are being targeted, and they are asking questions about the Tory government. Pensioners, of course, who often are the ones who do go out and vote Tory.
Yeah, I don't think we're targeting pensioners. Actually, what we're trying to do is get more resources into social care. And I think hearing Tim Farron today talking about this as if it's a tough deal for people with Alzheimer's, it's not as if the current system is working. It's not as if people are currently getting the domiciliary care or the nursing home care that they need. And this does, let's remember, the fundamental point is this is getting extra resources into social care, but instead of doing it by putting a further burden on younger people, many of whom are not enjoying any higher living standards than pensioners, we're saying that more affluent pensioners have to contribute, and quite rightly so.
It's a big shift away from her predecessor, David Cameron, and we've been hearing from Carl Emerson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, who points out that Theresa May is pursuing a very different approach to Mr. Cameron. The guarantee that pensions will rise by at least 2.5% has gone. It's now a double rather than triple lock. There's the proposal to means test winter fuel payments, and he guaranteed all pensioner benefits. And of course, that decision on social care, which means nobody with assets of less than £100,000 would have to pay for care. But that calculation, Carl Emerson says, would include the value of any property, even for those receiving help at home.
It's quite a contrast to the last election, where the Conservatives were looking to cut social security spending, but all of those cuts were going to come from working age individuals. Now we have the Conservative Party manifesto not setting out anything in terms of tax rises or welfare cuts for working age people. But for pensioners, there's a takeaway in terms of the winter fuel payments from better off pensioners. There's also a takeaway in terms of a less generous care system than the one that they legislated for just a couple of years ago. We're still trying to crunch those numbers. It's quite complicated to work out exactly how many people will be affected. It depends on the exact rules in their local authority in the country. So we don't have a figure as yet, but it is a takeaway. It's on average people will be made worse off from the measure.
So, David Willetts, it's a takeaway from pensioners, older people who in many cases tend to vote Tory, as I said. And there is some disquiet, isn't there, among Tories about the potential impact on traditional voters? You must be hearing that from colleagues.
Of course. I mean, I see the media and support my colleagues who are out campaigning. But look, the backdrop to this is a massive change in British society, which is in many ways a good change, that pensioners used to be on average poorer than everyone else. That is no longer the case. An average pensioner household will be enjoying living standards about the same as an average working household. So instead of having the picture, which we had when I first went into politics, that pensioner equals poverty, it's a great piece of economic and social progress. That's no longer the case. So it is right that our help for pensioners, for example, through the winter fuel payment, should be means tested so it focuses on the less affluent pensioners instead of going to all pensioners, however high their incomes. And this isn't really a takeaway from pensioners. This is saying we need to improve social care for older people, but that instead of being financed by younger people, many of whom are themselves struggling to make ends meet, should be financed out of pensioners who have substantial assets, and we draw on those only after they've died. And I think that's fair. I actually personally think it's one of the bravest, most serious and most important features of this manifesto. It's saying we've got to offer a fair deal between the generations.
Stuart Wood, your party is not in favour of this at all, but under the old system, you could be required to spend everything above £23,000, couldn't you? Now you can keep £100,000 under the Tory manifesto proposals, and your home won't be sold while you or your spouse or partner are still alive. Isn't that fair when there is a great need to pump money into the social care system?
I don't think it is fair, because you have to look at the system change as a whole. I mean, to be fair to the Conservatives, they are trying to broach the question of how to pay for something that is a rising cost for society. And there is superficial fairness in the sense that people who have more later in life should be paying more. I understand that. But it's not the problem with this reform is it's not a long-term system solution because it abandons the principle of social insurance. The biggest risk, the biggest unknown risk we all face in our lives is how long we're going to live and the illness we will face and the care we will need in the last few years of our life and how long those years will last. And this introduces not just a system that's arbitrary, distinguish between some kinds of illness where you won't have to pay a lot and others where you will have to pay an unknown, you know, huge amount. But it also means that we are not pooling the risks. We're not adopting as a society the principle that people in unknown circumstances pay an amount. In the event that they need it, they'll be able to draw down more, and people who don't need it will be paying more. That's a basic social insurance principle which we should apply across our welfare system, and in old age care, it should apply more than ever.
But, you know, you've got affluent home counties, southern areas that probably would pay more. In lower income areas where houses cost less, you would pay less. What's wrong with that?
It's right that people who have more should pay more and people who have less should pay less. But we should. A country like Germany, 25 years ago, saw this problem coming and decided in a system where there was an increase, a modest increase in tax to provide a basic level of social insurance. So no matter what your needs were, a basic amount will be covered later in life. And then that's topped up with income based on whether you can afford it later in life as a sort of second tier. Now, that seems to be a much more serious approach to a kind of solution, which is systemic, rather than just trying to take away from wealthy now and give to poor now.
But Stuart, first of all, of course, we should remember the current system is one in which if you've got more than £23,000, you then have to meet the full cost. So this is increasing the allowance from 23,000 to 100,000, though of course admittedly including domiciliary care now. That is actually a massive help to many less affluent pensioners. And secondly, I understand what you're saying about the German system and social insurance, but that would involve putting up higher national insurance contributions on the working population to make another transfer to the older generation. And I personally think we can no longer expect the younger generation, the working generation, to be the people who pay higher and higher taxes when the pensioners themselves are now, thank heavens, enjoying decent living standards.
That isn't how I see an insurance principle. An insurance principle is we're asking people to pay now for unknown circumstances in their own lives later, as well as for people who are older now. That's what a decent insurance principle does.
Did you, Brock, let me bring you in here, because the SNP, of course, continue to fund free personal care, don't you?
That's
will
right.
Will you continue to do that? We've got your manifesto coming this week.
Yes, it's coming on Tuesday. We're a bit of a disadvantage. Unfortunately, all the other parties have had theirs last week. But we do offer free personal care to over 65s. We're also currently conducting a feasibility study on extending to under 65s with distinct needs, such as children, for example, with severe disabilities.
What about continuing winter fuel payments?
Yes, we've committed to continue those as well.
But of course, you know...
We've had to mitigate quite a lot of conservative policies, unfortunately. We've paid about £400 million over the last few years to mitigate the effects of the bedroom tax, which has been very welcome up here, but unfortunately we see continuing down in Westminster with the Conservative government.
The thing is, though, David, are we seeing a sort of crossing of the Rubicon moment for Theresa May, because there is some disquiet among Tories about the potential impact on traditional voters. Tories taking money away from wealthy older people, offering help to lower incomes. We had those words, didn't we, from Theresa May at the launch of the manifesto saying she rejected untrammelled free markets, rejecting the cult of selfish individualism. Are we seeing a shift in Tory focus?
I think we are seeing some important shifts, and part of it is just a shift in the background that all politicians have to work against. What we've got is an ageing population. We're going to have an increased number of older people, which pushes up public spending and spending on public services they need, quite understandably and rightly. We've at the same time still got a budget deficit that we want to bring down, and we've got a working age population. It might actually be a bit smaller than we previously thought if we're really tough on migration. Put all those pressures together, and it's very hard to see how, in the decades to come, elections are going to be fought around uncosted giveaways or vague suggestions that if you want a goodie, somehow the money will turn up. What she has done, with exactly the kind of common sense one would expect it to, is you say, OK, there's a big problem out there, social care. We've got to show how we're going to tackle it. and we've got to show how we're going to pay for it. And we're going to pay for it in a fair and progressive way. And I think that that is the days when British politics, we had a nice, big, working-age population and not many dependents because there were fewer pensioners and they were generating higher and higher taxes. Those days are over. It's a much tougher backdrop for the next couple of decades. And politics is going to change as a result.
Deirdre.
Forgive me, hasn't the Conservative manifesto been considerably criticised this week for not containing any costings? I mean, they spent a lot of time, of course, pouring through the Labour manifesto and criticising it for the same thing.
And we will be talking about costings a little later, but I just wanted to stick on this idea of the social care plans, the plans for pensioners, the winter fuel announce. I mean, Deirdre, you say you will continue the winter fuel payment. The Labour in 2015 was saying take it away from the top 5%, weren't you, Stuart?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that would only have affected what people earning above 43,000 and it wouldn't have brought in the necessary money, would it, to really help the social care system in the way that...
On the winter fuel allowance?
Yes.
Mean? No, the winter fuel allowance is not a solution to the social care system. And I agree. I mean, David's right that all parties have to grapple with this generational shift that needs to happen over the next 20, 30 years. There's no doubt about that. And, I mean, at least in 2015 with the winter fuel allowance, we didn't pretend it was a solution. It was a beginning of trying to challenge the needs, the public finance needs that applied to the welfare system. But at least we specified who would lose the winter fuel allowance. What's extraordinary about the Tory manifesto is saying some people are going to lose it, but we're not going to tell you who it is, which means it's easy for Labour and everyone else to say every pensioner now thinks they may lose it. And I'm baffled, as purely as a matter of political tactics, why the Conservatives did it. I'm quite grateful they did it, but I find it very, very strange.
George Parker.
Well, I agree with that. I find it strange. I mean, the social care, the pensioner package in the Tory manifesto is a package written by people who think they're going to win the election quite comfortably. You only have to contrast that with some of the gimmicks and giveaways that David Cameron was promising back in 2015 because they thought Labour were on the verge of victory, and contrast it with this, which is much more upfront. But I'm not sure the social care package is going to get through in the next Parliament. I think Tory MPs will face a lot of very sad stories on the doorstep, which they'll bring back to Westminster. And you can already see the Conservative press starting to turn against this policy. It was really interesting. The day it was launched, we were presented this around about 6:30 in the evening, so we have very little time to scrutinise it. The Daily Mail gave the policy the benefit of the doubt. But you've seen over the last 72 hours the headlines in the Tory press hardening against this policy. The dementia tax is being adopted by right-wing newspapers to describe this policy. And I suspect that when it comes to it after the election, this policy is going to have to be substantially rewritten.
Well, that's interesting because Damien Green, the Work and Pensions Secretary, was talking to Andrew Marr this morning and he was asked, could there be changes ahead?
Is there any chance at all you're going to look at it again?
No. What we said in the manifesto, incidentally, to just put that no in context, is that we have set out this policy, which we're not going to look at again. There will be a green paper covering both social care and health coming out in the summer, because we all know that the long-term solution to the social care crisis is better integration of the NHS and social care. That's the aim of our policy. This is the first step along that road.
So the first step, David, under the Conservatives, there is no cap and the bill could be endless. Could you look at setting an upper limit? So saying that you keep £100,000 of your income, but you only spend a certain amount towards social care. Would that alleviate some of the problems?
Well, look, I'm not a minister or a front bench spokesman. What I'm going by is what I read in the manifesto, which puts this in the context of something I really care about. And I think not just me, I think lots of pensioners care about, which is a fair deal for different generations. But as Damien said, there's going to be a green paper, there's going to be a consultation document. And I think that the wider challenge of getting NHS linked in to social care better is really important. There's still serious problems of bed blocking, of people who are ready to go back home but who are delayed because the social service support is not in place. I had that experience in my own family and I know how distressing it can be. So there's still a lot more to be done. But I think that we should... What this has actually opened up, I think, is a really good debate about if we don't want to impose extra tax burdens on working-age families, but we have got an ageing population with greater needs, how do we pay for it? And there is no neat, politically appealing, nice solution where we somehow find magic money and nobody pays for it. And I think that this is brave in the way that he's trying to show that it is reasonable to expect the estates, not pensioners during their lives, but the estates of pensioners to make a contribution to those costs, but protecting the first £100,000.
Well, of course, Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband discussed that idea, maybe a limited fund. What was it, about £20,000 that could be taken out of a house after the person died to help pay towards their care costs?
I mean, I do, in the spirit of cross-partisanship, I do agree with David that what this will produce is a national debate about the structure of social care and some tough choices. A few years ago, when people were putting ideas forward, the words death tax or whatever were thrown back at them, and that shut down debate. I think we've moved on from that. We have to move on from that now. But that clip from Damien Grimm, I'd feel sorry for him. He got quite pummeled this morning defending the policy. One of the great lines of the campaign, let me put that no in context, he said. this has a feel of the Nix reversal, the national insurance reversal. It's just that they can't do the reversal before the election. So if the Conservatives win, I agree with George Parker, I think they're going to reverse it in the dressed up as a sort of consultation over the summer, blah, blah, blah. But it cannot survive. But the good thing, as David Willett says, is that we'll have a debate now about the crunchy choices as a country we're going to have to face.
Of course, Deirdre, if you get back into Westminster, you and your colleagues will be there. You'll be watching this taking shape, won't you? And you'll be there to have your say on things like a green paper.
Absolutely, yes. Although it would depend, because this would be not applicable in Scotland, so they could well be subject to the EVIL constrictions where we can't vote on English legislation. But I know my colleague, Philippa Whitford, who is our health spokesperson down there, has a keen interest in what's happening in the English NHS and in social care generally down there. So you can be certain we'll be speaking up about it.
And in terms of pension levels, you are getting more powers over taxations, but you can't control pension levels, can you?
No, that's not one of the things that's been devolved to us yet, but we live in hope.
So, George, you think that there will be changes. What about looking then, or starting to look at other benefits? You're saying that perhaps there's a possibility of reviving a cross-party consensus, at least in this studio, and I wonder whether it could go further, because there was an attempt before. The Dilnot proposals came forward, which came up with that idea of a £72,000 cap. Do you think there is a possibility, if a rethink happens after the election, that the parties could get together? Or, well, I don't know. What do you think?
I wouldn't push that too far.
I could get together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just, the world isn't like that.
If you think back to 2010, there was an attempt to get a cross-party agreement together. And it came up with, actually, I thought, rather a neat solution, which was the so-called hated Labour death tax, which proposed a 10% levy on all estates. So it wasn't the lottery. You end up paying, if you get dementia, everybody was going to pay 10%, and that would put money directly into the social care system. I think actually going back to 2010 wouldn't be such a bad idea.
And what about looking at other benefits, maybe travel allowances, prescriptions, TV licences? Do you think that the BBC, which funds the TV licence now, should look to means test that as well? What do you think?
Well, I think once you've gone down the means testing route for the winter fuel allowance, you should go the whole hog. And I'm sure that this is a taster of things to come, actually, because, I mean, David's point is right. What this reveals is that Theresa May is serious about tackling the question of intergenerational fairness, and I think this is just a taster of the kind of policies that we'll see a bit more of if she wins the election.
What do you think, David Willetts?
Well, it's for the BBC after 2020, I think, isn't it? What you do?
You can express an opinion.
I personally think that the... if some of what I've said sounds as if I kind of think, I'm not against pensioners. I actually find that pensioners... Let me put it...
You heard it here first.
Let me put it here.
I actually think pensioners care about their children and grandchildren, and pensioners want a fair deal between the generations. So this isn't... It would be terrible if this became a kind of generational war. Pensioners want their own children and grandchildren to be able to live in a decent house. So, for example, there's been a massive shift in attitudes to more house building, which I think is one of the other really important proposals in the manifesto. And actually, where to be fair to Stuart, there's Labour ambition as well for more house building. Mm. I think that there's a recognition that you can't expect more and more taxes from the working age population. So I personally think, provided we can, provided pensioners can see that this is in the interests of their children and grandchildren, this is winnable. And I don't know how many of their children and grandchildren are paying the TV licence and watching TV. I suspect that maybe more of the older people are actually spending the time watching it.
All right, well, look... Sorry, Deirdre, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, we've lost the triple lock, according to the Conservative manifesto. Your means testing
you've got
your
a double
fuel
lock
payments.
Now.
Yes, indeed. And this really is the suggestion that in some way pensioners are rolling in money at the expense of young people, I think, is quite an offensive one. I certainly am very much aware of considerable pensioner poverty. I come across it every day on the doors, knocking doors, canvassing as I am at the moment. And I think... I actually find that quite offensive. Right.
Let's be clear then. First of all, of course, there's a double lock, which means that pensions will rise by prices or earnings, so that they will not fall back.
But the triple lock has been lost.
But they will not fall back compared with, in other words, for the working population, it's earnings, so pensions will be prices and earnings, quite rightly. And secondly, of course, there is some pensioner poverty. But the good news about Britain is there is much less pensioner poverty than there was. And I suspect after this programme, I may get one or two letters from... older pensioners saying they are finding life a struggle. I understand there are some pensioners who find it a struggle. But you have to look at the averages and you have to recognise that overall one of the great successes is now, if anything, on average, a pensioner income, once you allow the fact that it may well be a smaller household, is about as good as, if not slightly higher, than a working age family's income. This is a way in which Britain has changed.
If I can just give you a figure relating to Scotland. Age Scotland research shows that over 200,000 over 65s in Scotland are struggling financially. So
yeah, and let's
suggesting
focus help on
pensioner
them.
Poverty
let's focus
doesn't
help
exist
on them.
Or only get one or two
let's
letters
Let's focus
on
help
it.
On them. We don't need to worry so much about Richard Branson and Alan Sugar.
Well, that's the question about the means testing, but of course we don't know where that level will be set. Now, look, the costings, we talked about them earlier. In the run-up to the manifestos, we were all wondering how detailed the plans would be and what costings there would be. Labour and the Liberal Democrats did produce a detailed table of their spending commitments and tax measures to pay for them. The Conservatives didn't. In fact, we counted up the pound signs. There were 28 pound signs in an 84-page booklet. Labour, of course, has been dogged by questions, you know this, Stuart Wood, about economic credibility. Sure. So on Friday, the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, told me he had insisted on spelling out the costs clearly.
I think people want you to be absolutely clear on, you know, what policies you want, how much is it going to cost and where's the funding source. And I've always taken that as a almost standard practice. So, and I've been surprised that elections were... major political parties don't do that. So I said this 18 months, well, soon after I became Shadow Chancellor, I said, this is what we'll always do from here on in. So I just want to make it standard practice.
Isn't it risky?
Well, not, you know, you have, people are able then to say, I don't think this figure is right, and you can have that debate, or they can say, I don't agree with this funding source, or I don't agree with the policy or your priority. That's democracy, that's an election, that's what it's all about.
Stuart Wood, is it a hostage to fortune to publish a document like this with spending commitments on one side, tax measures on the other, with gaps that have been found afterwards?
Well, I can see why some people think it's brave in the politician sense of brave. But actually, look, Labour's weakness under us, when I worked with Ed and Gordon after the crash, and under Jeremy obviously as well, is a suspicion that things aren't affordable. They want to spend things and they can't afford to do so. So going out of the way to cost out how you're going to do it, I think is exactly the right strategy for Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell. I think it's exactly what they should do. I think one of the whatever you think of Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell's Labour Party, this manifesto bears the hallmarks of what they really, really believe. It has ideological clarity to it. It is a shift in the boundary between the state and the market, obviously in the idea of public ownership coming back into rail and mail and the railways as well, but also in the explicit use of tax, in particular tax on business in some areas and higher income earners to fund explicit commitments on services. So there's some clarity about it. And I think it is a Jeremy Corbyn manifesto in that respect.
George Parker, though, the level of largesse in this document has been pointed out. I mean, you know, you've got Labour protecting middle-income and wealthy people in many cases, promising to scrap tuition fees at a cost of £11 billion, promising free school lunches even when wealthy families can afford them. Do you think that the figures add up?
Well, there's a specific question about how Labour would fund their renationalisation programme, and that hasn't really been thoroughly expressed. But I think Stuart's right that there was a sort of admirable effort to try to make the sums add up, and you know, you could see where the money was coming from, and you could see the intent, which was basically the Labour Party is prepared to borrow large amounts of money, £250 billion over the Parliament over a decade from borrowing, and the rest of the money would come from big business and from the wealthy. It was a, you know, it was a valiant attempt to show where the money was coming from. However, I think the question has to be asked about whether that money would actually come in, because rich people and businesses are very good at changing their behaviour, and they would change their behaviour. And then the question is, if the sums don't add up, would the Labour Party then be coming for your taxes if you were further down the income scale?
So, Stuart, you say that you commend Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell for doing this, even though there may be risks
I think that's right. I mean, there's a lot of people have talked about this being a return to 1983. So I looked at 1983 manifesto, and there's nothing in Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto on capital controls, currency controls, nothing on reversing the 80s trade union legislation, nothing on nationalising British aerospace, nationalising other infrastructure things, but no five-year plans. There's a bit on Brexit, by the way, which bears an uncanny resemblance to Theresa May's policy. But what it is, I think, is an attempt, as I say, to sort of challenge some of the economic liberal achievements of the last 30 years, which the Thatcher years began and then were continued. And it does it through public ownership, in limited ways, but on sort of big industrial sort of things like railways and energy. It does it through tax, and it does it through, as George Parker said, a very Keynesian approach to borrowing to spend on infrastructure. Now, that puts Britain, if Jeremy Corbyn wins, if he did all that, that puts Britain basically in the mainstream of West European democracies, actually. It's a mark of how far down the right-wing economic liberal track we went that this is considered sort of left-wing radicalism. Actually, it's sort of social democracy, really, in the post-European mould.
I suppose the question is, though, whether it works, whether it gets people to vote Labour, whether it manages to stop the Conservatives hoovering up as much of the UKIP vote, which had already been hoovered up by... which had already been hoovering up Labour votes in the north. You know, there's been this knock-on, and the Conservatives are hoping to reap back those votes, aren't they, in the north and the Midlands?
No, I agree, and I don't think it's a manifesto that sort of it's not a mosaic of tactical ploys in order to get different bits. I think it expresses a long-standing ideological position that Jeremy Corbyn ran for leadership on, won again on, and is now fighting an election on. So it has clarity. It's not everyone's cup of tea inside the Labour Party. And, you know, personally, I think there's too little, for example, on sort of re-engineering the supply side of our economy, the way our economy works, the way our corporate governance system works. That's a big challenge for us as a country, and I'd like more on that. So we all have views about what couldn't have been in there, but I think there is clarity and a sort of genuineness about this.
And David, when it comes to costings, I mean, we mentioned the Conservatives do not have many costings in here. They weren't able to give a costing either for reducing immigration to the tens of thousands. Now, that figure, you've been unhappy about that in the past. Do you think it was a mistake to put that once again into this manifesto?
Well, I mean, there's clearly part of the mood in the country that people are responding to post-Brexit is on migration. I think it's very hard to bring it down to the tens of thousands, and it's very hard to see in the immediate future how you could do it, given that we already have substantial migration from outside the EU, when we've already had the power to take greater controls if we wished. I personally do think, however, that we should look much more at how we train and upskill our own people. I mean, thinking back to my time as a minister in David Cameron's cabinet, one of our frustrations was that you had the kind of migration advisory committee sitting there identifying areas where there are skill shortages and we needed to therefore bring in migrant workers to plug gaps. But there wasn't a neat, clear, straightforward way where we could use that data and put it into skills funding in Britain to meet the skills shortages that were being identified by this other part of government. And I think in the Tory manifesto, and some of this in the Labour manifesto as well, to be fair to Stuart, I think that the focus... One thing, if this does at least kickstart a proper debate about how we deliver better vocational and skills and technical training in this country and set ourselves some serious ambitions, that would be a good thing.
OK, but you'd rather it hadn't been in there, basically, is what I interpret with that. George, we have other manifestos coming up this week and a few other events outside the campaigns, don't we?
We do, and I think you know, we're going to get some of the SNP manifestos coming out, as we were just hearing from Deirdre, and we're going to have a series of Andrew Neil question and answer sessions with the party leaders, and Theresa May is going first tomorrow. I think that will be interesting. I think Andrew Neil is one of the finest interviewers, not the son of you, of course, Caroline, but
he is way above me.
They are going to be great interviews this week.
Way above me.
But I think later on, I think in the week, Theresa May will be going off to the NATO summit in Brussels, and then she'll be going to a G7 summit in Sicily. And I think that will be an opportunity for her to get back into the campaign where she wants to be, which is talking about strong leadership on the international stage. She'll be meeting Emmanuel Macron, the French president, for the first time since he became president in Brussels. And I think we'll see a lot of that sort of Theresa May as the world statesman taking difficult decisions. And I think she needs to get back onto that as quickly as possible after the last 48 hours of headlines.
And what's going to be the reaction at Tory HQ about this weekend, do you think?
The
Svengalis behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, Lynton Crosby, the guy who's run the last few Conservative Party campaigns, will be spitting blood about what's happened here. You know, his mantra is you scrape the barnacles off the boat, you don't have distractions. This was supposed to be a straightforward campaign which put Theresa May up against Jeremy Corbyn, and it was a contest he had no doubt he could win. But having 48 hours dominated by ministers going on the television, on the radio, on the defensive, on a policy which seems to be aimed like a dagger at the heart of the Tory vote, is exactly the kind of thing he doesn't want to see.
All right. And Deirdre, what are you going to be doing for the SNP manifesto launch then?
For the manifesto launch, in terms of where we're holding it?
Or, yes. What's the plan?
It's next Tuesday, so I think, I'm not quite sure if I can reveal where it is. I think it's probably the best kept secret
Scotland.
Scotland, yes, that's a good point. But I do think, I can't really say anything at the moment. We've already discussed our commitment to the triple lock for pensions and to the winter fuel allowance, but...
The Tories are galloping up hard, aren't they, behind you? And you've got Ruth Davidson, who says that she, as a Conservative leader in Scotland, would keep the winter fuel allowance. So, you know, different
message
to down south.
Yes, although it's not, of course, devolved to us till 2019. But when that is, we've certainly committed to keep it. But I think one of the on the doorsteps, just in terms of what the issues are that are of importance to the people of Scotland that I'm speaking to anyway, it's about Brexit. And so I can expect there to be mention of that, of course, at the launch on Tuesday. But I think this, for us, is really about having Scottish MPs who are actually there to stand up for Scotland, to speak up for Scotland's interests against a Tory government. And at a time when, frankly, the Labour Party, with the best will in the world, and, you know, there are some good things in the Labour manifesto, for example. We know that because, of course, quite a few of them are borrowed from us. We're already implementing, like, free university tuition, ending hospital parking charges, and the abolition of the bedroom tax.
Yeah.
But the Brexit is the thing that's coming up on the doors
Brexit
all the time.
And independence, I think, are the two key issues, aren't they?
But independence has already been settled. They've got a mandate for that in the Scottish Parliament. Scottish Parliament has taken that vote.
I haven't had the second referendum yet. But anyway, look, let's have a look at Northern Ireland, because the general election has come at a very difficult time for Northern Ireland. The Assembly at Stormont currently suspended. Mm-hmm. There are questions about how the 300-mile border with the Irish Republic will be managed after the UK leaves the EU. And Brexit itself is a sensitive subject, with a majority in Northern Ireland having voted to remain. The Prime Minister paid a flying visit there last weekend, but our reporter Keith McDougall stayed a little longer, visiting several different parts of Northern Ireland to gauge the mood there.
It's 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, and the Irish pubs in the centre of Derry, or Londonderry, are full. Not just with folk from here, but with people on a night out from their homes in the Irish Republic, just 4 miles away. Outside the pubs stand the taxi drivers, who'll be taking the revellers home, some across that border, which in 2 years' time will be where the EU begins and ends.
If it's a hard border, then for you to be taking fares up here and taking them over the border, then it's going to be a whole passport and rigmarole, and where they go and where you're taking them. It's just going to be a nightmare for taxi men.
If they put the customs on the border, they'll close the smaller roads down. There's a lot more queues at the border then. If we go back to the old days and the checkpoints were there.
And going back to the old days is what the vast majority of Northern Ireland citizens don't want to do. as this mother remarked to me next morning in Derry.
I actually have a daughter attending school in the Republic, so that would be a bit of a disaster having to go through a border every day to get my daughter to school. I suppose my family grew up through the Troubles, so the last thing they want to see is a border there again.
How are you? Good to see you. You're local and working locally, aren't you?
I am, yes.
And have you been following the Brexit issue?
I have. It's interesting at the moment because...
In another part of Northern Ireland, Colin McGrath of the SDLP is out canvassing shoppers in the streets of South Down.
Brexit is obviously the biggest issue that's going to impact certainly the north of Ireland in a generation. We have a lot of community groups that rely on the funding that comes from the European Union, and we're a largely agricultural and fisheries-based industries in the area.
Colin McGrath said the SDLP favoured building what he called a Remain alliance of parties to fight for Northern Ireland's interests in the Brexit process. But, he says, the snap general election prevented it happening. And too often, he says, London-based ministers just don't get Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland is a very delicate political situation. It needs people that are interested, determined and able to provide leadership. And I don't think we would have been able to explain that in detail to Theresa May during her 25-minute visit to Northern Ireland, which I think indicates the interest that she has.
And at the top of the staircase, we have a bronze statue of Lord Cregavan, who was the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland.
The Democratic Unionist Christopher Stalford takes me on a tour of the majestic Stormont Parliament building on the outskirts of Belfast. There's plenty to look at.
From the ceiling we have gold chandeliers that were originally a gift from the German Kaiser.
Stormont is currently not in use for serious politics and hasn't been since January when the power-sharing executive broke down. But even when the Assembly was sitting, was it actually achieving very much? The DUP's Christopher Stalford says plenty.
I think we can be proud of the fact that Northern Ireland is making headlines across the world for the right reasons. You look at things like the fact that Game of Thrones, for example, was filmed here. The fact that we attracted the highest level of foreign direct investment into this country in our history. Unemployment's at the lowest level that it has been in 45 years.
Tori, Lauren, do you want to do from the top on that side and keep the right-hand side, and Danny and I will do the left-hand side coming down?
Yeah, sure.
Steve Aitken is out knocking on doors as part of the Ulster Unionist campaign team in Antrim.
There are more dogs in today than there are anybody else, by the look of it.
Mr Aitken is frustrated at the four-month-long suspension of the Stormont Assembly, as it means, he says, there's no one at the helm of Northern Ireland as Brexit unfolds.
It would be better if we had an Assembly, particularly with Brexit coming up. It's going to be focused on London. It's going to be focused, particularly since Northern Ireland hasn't got its act together. Scotland's already got a plan. Wales has got a plan. I think the Cornish County Council have got a plan. Belfast hasn't got a plan.
Steve Aitken says constructive talks to get Stormont going again were sent crashing by the general election, a trigger for parties to bicker and argue and not work together. In March, there had been elections to Stormont, and the results were significant. Sinn Féin won 27 Assembly seats, just one behind the DUP's 28 seats.
I think that there was 1,200 votes between the two, and that is remarkable.
Journalist Alison Morris is a close observer of Northern Ireland politics for the Irish Times.
We're living, you know, in a place that was created to maintain a unionist majority. And so here we have, you know, almost reaching the 100th anniversary of the creation of that state, and the unionists have lost their majority, and I think that sent fear into their hearts.
Christopher Stalford of the DUP accepts the outcome of the March elections was a wake-up call for his party. So is unionism in crisis? Get real, he says.
When this place was closed in 1972, people thought that was us in crisis. When the Anglo-Irish Agreement came about, people thought that was a crisis. We have weathered many storms. We are confident going forward, and I see real encouragement in what's happening in Scotland, where it appears as though the SNP is being pegged back. And I hope that in Northern Ireland, unionist voters will come out.
Hello, Sinn Féin. You're Conor Murphy speaking.
Conor Murphy is helping to run the Sinn Féin campaign in the border constituency of Newry and Armagh, where the party tends to poll strongly. He freely admits Brexit is doing the historic cause of Irish republicanism no harm at all.
The Brexit issue is going to cause huge damage to Ireland. Nobody ought to be under any illusions that whatever way political developments take course over the next number of years, Brexit, the exit from Europe against our wishes of the northern part of this island, the imposition of border controls and tariffs is going to cause significant political and economic damage to Ireland. Now, I think that is an added impetus for people who want to see change. There's no doubt about that. And the issue of Irish reunification has become more of a mainstream dialogue now over the last year than it had been for some time.
There's a fifth party in the mainstream of Northern Ireland politics, the Cross Community Alliance Party. A former Alliance MP, Naomi Long, accuses Theresa May's government of pursuing the wrong sort of Brexit for Northern Ireland.
We certainly believe in terms of Northern Ireland that we need to protect the freedom of movement that we have, not only because it's important economically and socially, but because it's important politically in Northern Ireland, and it's part of the expectation that flows from the Good Friday Agreement.
While Brexit adds a different dimension to this latest round of voting, the election here remains framed in that familiar unionist versus nationalist context. And Steve Aitken of the Ulster Unionists suggests no one should start making plans for any major change in this part of the world.
No, I think in 20 years' time, I think Northern Ireland will be a confident, prosperous part of the United Kingdom, a United Kingdom that will contain Scotland, Wales, England and Northern Ireland, and will be a great country going forward. And I don't want to sound like Theresa May, because you never call me a Tory, but actually I think we are stronger together.
Whatever happens at the general election, some voters in Belfast gave me a message that they hope to see a different form of politics here in the future.
Excuse me, are you likely to be voting?
Yes, uh-huh. We're fed up with the same politicians that's been here. The colours, you know, I don't want to vote colours. I want to vote for someone that's there, that's going to put things in place for our children of the future. And it's not about colour anymore. So.
Not about orange and green anymore?
Yeah, no. Exactly. Yeah, uh-huh.
I think our politicians need to go past that, actually.
Do you think the politicians live in the past a bit?
Yeah, too much so. Really, truthfully, yeah.
That was Keith McDougall reporting. And we have the papers, the front pages. There's a bit of an Ireland theme in some of them. George.
Yes, there is. Well, the Conservative Central Office will be pleased with the headlines in the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail, which are focusing on comments Jeremy Corbyn made in an interview today where he was asked to condemn IRA bombings during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and he refused five times to denounce the IRA specifically, and instead he stated his opposition to all bombing. This makes the headlines in the Daily Telegraph. Corbyn engulfed in IRA furore. The Daily Mail's got Corbyn's kick in the teeth for IRA victims. So Jeremy Corbyn always knew in this campaign that his former connections with the IRA would become a campaign issue. And I think Central Office will be pleased that the Conservative supporting press has moved on to that now to move away from the big debate over the weekend over the dementia tax, which incidentally does also feature on the front pages too. The Financial Times have got senior Tories were kept in the dark over May's dementia tax, that the manifesto was drawn up in conditions of total secrecy, very few ministers consulted.
Do you think that's the case then, David? Can you imagine? I mean, you can read the sort of body language of people like Boris Johnson when they're asked about this. Do you think Theresa May and just a very close set of colleagues will have decided this whole manifesto?
Well, I don't know what happened. The only thing one can observe, of course, is this was an unexpected election call suddenly. So the whole process would have been different than when you are running up with years to go. So inevitably, it had been compressed.
The Eye says Tories stand firm after care wobble. So
yep, no change to the policy, indeed. And the Times has got an interesting take on the whole social care question. They've done some research which suggests, or found some research which suggests that people in some parts of the country are struggling to exercise their legal right to defer residential care payments until after their death because some local authorities are making it difficult or impossible to strike a deal. And their headline is Care Crisis Threatens to Scupper May Reforms, saying that because local authorities are refusing to let people to defer the cost until after their death, that will undermine the whole reform process.
And, of course, when we're talking about the questions about the IRA, it's not connections with the IRA, it's just the comments that he has made about the IRA over the years.
Over the years, exactly, yes.
So, David, just to bring this to a close, we've been talking today, I mean, again, the front pages talking about the reforms that Theresa May wants to bring in. Brexit, though, is underlying everything, isn't it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And we've talked about Brexit very little. And look, I was a Remainer. But now the challenge is negotiating this serious, close, long-term relationship with the EU. If we can't negotiate that, everything we hope to do domestically will be under threat. And I do think Theresa is the best person to do that. So it all there's a connection between this domestic policy debate and the Brexit negotiations. We have to get those negotiations right.
And in 10 seconds, Deirdre, that's exactly the point that you were making earlier, isn't it?
Well, yes, and I do think this whole lack of the lock on income tax, national insurance and VAT in the Tory manifesto is very alarming, and we should be wondering what is lying behind that and whether it's something to do with Brexit. I suspect it is.
Who knows? Stuart, just
a final point. I agree with David. Brexit is obviously the dominant issue of our time, which makes it even more stunning that in the Tory manifesto there's hardly anything on how Brexit's going to be conducted. I mean, Theresa May wanted a mandate for Brexit. There's no detail about what kind of Brexit she's going to pursue in this manifesto, so it's very difficult to know what kind of Brexit you're voting for.
Well, there's the white paper, and there's her, and there's her clear...
I wouldn't say that exactly illuminates the issue, then.
The question is, who's the person we could trust to negotiate it best?
Thank you very much. We have to leave it there. George Parker, David Willett, Stuart Wood, Deirdre Brock, thanks all. Join us again next week, same time, for the Westminster Hour.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.